This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now let's begin here.
Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
Yes, that's the voice of President George W. Bush in August 2005. He was praising then FEMA director Michael Brown in the wake of Hurricane Katrina's devastation of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. The unearned praise was frankly ridiculous, and it would later become soundbite evidence of just how out of touch President Bush was with the realities of his administration's multiple failures following Katrina. Dozens of levees failed. More than 1,200 people died. Hundreds of thousands were displaced, and more than $108 billion in property was destroyed. All while Director Brown was sending emails about his tie, declaring himself a fashion god and asking, "Can I just quit now?"
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Now, considering that approval ratings for President Bush plummeted to 30% following his mishandling of Katrina, it was a bit surprising to hear President Biden use similar language on Tuesday following New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's resignation announcement.
But he's done a hell of a job. And I mean, both on everything from access to voting to infrastructure to a whole range of things. That's why it's so sad.
Oh, Mr. President, you want to go with Governor Cuomo is doing a heck of a job? Nearly a dozen women have credibly accused Cuomo of sexual harassment. And even before their stories of gripping, groping, and general gubernatorial mistreatment, there was that little matter of Cuomo dragging his feet about New York City COVID-19 shutdown, his decision to slash Medicaid during a pandemic, his lethal policy choices about nursing home residents, and his unconscionable decision to effectively cover up the number of elderly who died as a result of his choices. So, Mr. President, unless you want to play President W. Bush to Governor Cuomo's Michael Brown act, I'm going to suggest you rethink whether you want to go characterize this guy's performance as
a heck of a job.
With me now to discuss why he called for Governor Cuomo's resignation in March is Dr. Stephen Thrasher, professor at Northwestern University and author of the forthcoming book, The Viral Underclass, How Racism, Ableism, and Capitalism Plague Humans on the Margins. Great to have you back, Stephen.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
So I was so pleased to be reminded again that it was back in March when you initially wrote this piece for Scientific American, suggesting that actually the governor was not doing a heck of a job. Can you talk a little bit about what you were zeroing in on in this piece?
Certainly. There have been two major reports that have been issued by New York State Attorney General Letitia James, the one that people probably heard about last week about sexual harassment, but the first one came out just a few days before I published that piece in Scientific American, and that one was about how Governor Cuomo and his staff had covered up the number of people who had been killed in nursing homes in the COVID pandemic. They'd originally said it had been about 6,500, and Letitia James found out that more than 12,000 had died in nursing homes, and they had basically cooked the books to try to make the governor look better, to make it look like he had done a heck of a job. And so, of course, it was very disturbing to find out the number was about double. But even if you go back to the original number, about 6,500, that was already an unacceptable number of dead. New York had, along with New Jersey and Michigan, the highest percent of people who had died in nursing homes. And one of the reasons that happened in New York State was because the Cuomo administration made the decision to send people who were recovering from the coronavirus into nursing homes to recover. And this had a predictably disastrous effect. It's one of the reasons why deaths were so high. 47 other states did not make that decision. They sent people recovering to dedicated wings or to dedicated spaces. But the Cuomo administration decided to send them to nursing homes. The nursing homes were not prepared. And nursing homes, of course, are not sort of set up to deal with new viruses or pathogens we don't know about. So it was a really disastrous, almost genocidal problem that the governor had created. And so that's why I initially thought he should resign.
Let's presume Governor Cuomo's intention wasn't, to sort of end up with 6,500 deaths. What was behind that decision, or what sort of executive function failures happened to allow that decision to be implemented, to send those who were recovering from COVID back into nursing homes?
Well, we have to look at the resources that were available at the time, and a lot of those resources were determined by Governor Cuomo's decisions over the decade that he had been governor prior to that. New York State shed about 20,000 hospital beds over the previous 20 years, and he was governor for half of that time. His administration personally oversaw the closure of a 500-bed hospital in Brooklyn just a few years before the pandemic. So we are working with a lot less. If we'd had those hospital beds, we would have had more space that we could send them. Governor Cuomo had also chosen to try to cut Medicaid spending by about $500 million in the pandemic in those early months. And we know that Medicaid is one of the most important tools we have to get money that's not even coming from the state budget. It's federal money. And it's one of the best tools we have to deal with public health in general, particularly for poor people. So in trying to not receive that money from the federal government, he was acting a lot like Republican governors in the South that a lot of New Yorkers will make fun of, the governors who had refused Medicaid spending. So all of that contributed to the fact that when we had this awful pandemic, we did not have the resources that we could have. And kind of poetically, this began before Governor Cuomo's time, but it contributed to St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City, which had been one of the major hospitals that had dealt with the AIDS crisis, that also had closed. And those kinds of closures of hospitals continued under Governor Cuomo. So we just didn't have the resources that we needed in that moment. And he was eschewing federal help when we should have been welcoming it and wanting more of it.
So why wouldn't this have been the key sort of media moment, sort of holding the governor accountable around human life, around, kind of key executive decisions that are made in the context of a pandemic? Instead, he gets dubbed by media as, America's governor.
This happened for a number of sad reasons that I'm writing about my forthcoming book. One is that the coronavirus pandemic began to kill people immediately in this country that we already broadly as a society consider disposable, and they've already been disappeared from view. So many people who are dying in nursing homes, these are people that are kind of institutionally warehoused and have been removed from society in the first place. So there's not a great amount of care about them. And so when many of them died, that was just considered kind of par for the course, which of course is very sad and unfortunate. Governor Cuomo also was foiling himself against President Trump. President Trump's no longer in office, so that takes away some of the cover he'd had. And of course, the media very consciously portrayed him as the opposite of Trump and his immediate darling. And that happened in no small part because of his brother, Chris Cuomo, who was a host of the CNN show, Cuomo Tonight. I found it really appalling, the whole concept of that show, and that it was named with the last name of the former governor and the current governor of New York, and the show was just called Cuomo. I found that always really inappropriate. Then Chris Cuomo brought his brother on. We now know that he was advising him later, but he brought him on and really puffed him up. Governor Cuomo was eventually given an Emmy for those press conferences. And the media was, frankly, broadly insufficiently critical at looking at his history of public health over the years, at looking at the ways that he did not keep our hospital beds at the level that they needed to be at, that he has refused to tax billionaires at the level that they should be taxed. And even in the pandemic, he really fought until he was on the ropes and the state legislature could kind of fight him on this. He really did fight raising taxes on the wealthy to make sure that we had the resources we needed in the pandemic and that we would have them to prepare looking forward. And so it was a failure of media to not look at history, to not look at the economic decisions by the governor over time, and then to also just kind of ignore the fact that these people we broadly considered disposable were being killed. And I took it very personally, and I'm writing about this in my book as well, because I had a close friend of mine who was a mentor editor of mine at the Village Voice, and he had gone into a hospital for a tooth infection, and then he got sent to a nursing home to recover, where he then got the coronavirus and died. And so I often think about would Ward still be alive if we had had dedicated wings and spaces for people with coronavirus rather than sending them into nursing homes, into these spaces that, you know, we sadly just don't care enough about as a society. And so that's why I think he got kind of a pass on the first one.
One thing I want to say, just I want to pause long enough to say, I'm so sorry to hear about that loss. And I know that for so many of us who took those gut punches early on, and then the horror that some of us are feeling about taking them now, right, that even after a vaccine, we continue to lose friends and loved ones and community members. So I want to just pause for a moment to acknowledge the humanity of that, because I think your point about nursing homes and the ways that we can remove people from view, the elderly, the poor, it actually does in so many ways resonate with me about Hurricane Katrina, and about the ways that precisely those vulnerable populations who folks didn't have to think about or look at or wonder about until people were on the roofs of their homes. And so I appreciate you know, doing that, the sunlight of disinfectant on this story.
Thank you. I interviewed for my book, The Activist, Alice Wong, who's a disability activist, and she talks so beautifully about congregate spaces where people can't leave. And so that includes poor people, you know, who are caught in floodwaters. It includes disabled people who are often also institutionalized, and people who are incarcerated. And we saw that with Hurricane Katrina. We saw, you know, people who could not leave prisons or were too poor to leave their neighborhoods and were kind of left for dead by the society until we were forced to look at them when this rupture happened. And in New York State as well, Governor Cuomo also really refused to be proactive about taking care of people who were incarcerated. He bragged about having them make hand sanitizer because people in prison are legally enslaved and can be forced to do whatever the state makes them do. And he sort of bragged about using them as a workforce, but he was not proactive about putting in measures to protect people in prison, and certainly not proactive about inoculating them early once we got the vaccination, so that rates continued to be quite bad in prisons. And these are all populations that are quite marginalized, and we are forced to look at them to some degree in moments of crisis, like the pandemic. But because they've already been disappeared in a way from day-to-day life, it becomes easier for them to feel the brunt of things in moments of crisis. And in that way, Governor Cuomo was not only, you know, negligent, but it was really offensive that he kind of went on this victory lap with his book, We Now Know, he got $5 million for, and bragged about what a great job he was doing. And that's actually seems to be the motivating factor for why they covered up the number of deaths, because he really wanted to look as good as possible for this book deal and not to try to protect the citizens of his state as effectively as he needed to, which should be the first order of business for any governor.
Dr. Stephen Thrasher is a professor at Northwestern University. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
It is with an eagerness to tackle the challenges ahead that I take the oath of office as New Jersey's 50th chief executive and its first woman governor.
That is former Garden State Governor Christine Todd Whitman at her 1994 inaugural address. She was the first and still only woman elected to serve as governor of New Jersey. She resigned as governor in 2001 to become the EPA administrator during the presidency of George W. Bush. And this came just a few months after she was embroiled in scandal over a photo showing her frisking a black man during a ride-along with Camden police back in 1996. Accused of racial profiling, she ultimately conceded she should have thought twice about that moment. As New York prepares to welcome Kathy Hochul as their next governor, after the resignation of Andrew Cuomo due to accusations of sexual harassment, Governor Whitman joined me to discuss this unique moment and what it's like to govern after scandal. She began by giving her reaction to New York Attorney General Letitia James's report detailing allegations of sexual harassment against Cuomo.
Well, it was devastating. And, you know, you'd heard all these accusations, and there'd been enough of them for you to suspect that this was real. What was going on was real. I thought his statement was less than forthcoming. He was trying to blame it on the fact that society had changed and he wasn't keeping up with it. I mean, he's younger than I am, and that behavior was not acceptable at any time. It was not a real mea culpa or apology, but that report was a devastating report, and it was backed up by fact.
So, part of what this moment means, in addition to the end of the governorship for Andrew Cuomo, is that in just a few short weeks, New York is going to have its first woman serve as governor. You, of course, were the first and still only woman to serve as governor of New Jersey. I'm wondering if you have maybe not words of advice per se, but perspective, sort of a way of thinking about what this moment might mean.
Well, frankly, you don't think of it as a moment of you being the first woman. You think of you're taking over the job of being a governor. And that's really what it's all about and what your focus is. I mean, yes, clearly you are a role model, but again, you don't run for office with the idea of being a role model. It's what you are, obviously, if you're the first on anything or if you're in a high position. People look to you and model watch you very carefully, and some model their behavior on your behavior. So I suspect right now, I mean, the lieutenant governor has spent a lot of time getting to know the state, going around. She's from Buffalo, but she's traveled to every county in New York. She's been part of New York political scene for really her entire career. And she is obviously a very capable person. She's someone who seems to be able to work across the aisle. She's politically savvy enough and has clearly been in touch enough to have a good handle of what she's going to have to do and the challenges she's facing.
Now, clearly, New York's soon-to-be governor is a Democrat. You're a Republican. But I'm wondering if you think that women govern differently in any discernible or important ways, and maybe less in the legislative positions where we so frequently see women as leaders, as senators, members of Congress, members of state legislators. But we have not had very many women serve as governor. And I'm wondering if there are ways that in those like executive positions, women, regardless of ideology or party, may govern differently.
I think absolutely. Again, once you start making generalizations, you can always find the exceptions. But I have found, and it's true in Congress, too, by the way, that women tend to be more collegial. I found as governor that by being a female governor, I empowered the female members of the legislature, and we prioritize differently. I used to say, you know, if you gave a woman the difference to spending money on a halfway house for kids or fixing a bridge, well, you perfectly well understand the importance of fixing the bridge. You tend to go with the personal part first. You'd go for the halfway house for kids and still find the money to do the bridge. But we tend to focus on people. We prioritize differently. We approach problem solving differently. We do. I mean, it's something you see around the world, actually. You see it corporations, too, when you put women on boards, when you have women CEOs, that things are handled in a different way. So it's important to get that diversity. I think it's way past time for New York. It's way past time for New Jersey to have another woman governor. And frankly, every state should have done it. There's no reason why not. Women are entirely capable of handling these positions. And sometimes some of what they bring in their way of approaching issues is very helpful to getting problems solved.
So why is it that women have had such difficulty becoming governor? Is this in part due to political parties that maybe don't recognize and back the talent of, you know, potential executives when they're women in ways that they might acknowledge, recognize, and back that power with their men who are candidates?
Well, you know, it is part of it is definitely that. You tend to do things with people with whom you relate the most, and men relate to men. And men have controlled the political system for a long time. I've seen many instances where a party will put a woman forward, but tend to put them in forward in districts or Senate races where they don't think they can win. And they just want to show, see, I'm a good person, I'm a good party, we have women candidates. But they don't support them. We've had a couple of egregious cases here in New Jersey where, fortunately, not the Republicans, but the Democrat Party that have just walked. Well, no, it happened to the Republicans, too. They've just walked away from their candidate, their gubernatorial candidate. They made deals, I guess, across the aisle, the men, and they just walked away and let the women flounder. In fact, when I ran for the Senate in 1990 against Bill Bradley, that was essentially the thinking behind the party, because he was so popular then, and he'd won for his first reelection by 16 percentage points, that they didn't think I'd come anywhere near. And in fact, the Republican Senate Campaign Committee took away the money at the very end that they were that they had promised me, which was our only advertising budget that we had, because they said there were other challenger candidates who could do better. It turned out I did the best of any of the challengers, but I didn't win. But that we see that happening over and over again, and that's where a big mistake is made. I mean, women are better than 50% of the voters. My husband always said, "What's the matter with women? Why don't they vote for women? You could control the world if you did." And I've always maintained, yes, that's true. But I think one of the things that holds us back, and we're more critical of women because we relate to them more directly. And if they mess up, then we mess up. You know, it's a reflection on us. I don't know if that's true, but that's my theory of it.
So let me ask a difficult question then on exactly that point. During the years that you served as governor in New Jersey, you had many particularly exceptional, what we would think of now as green accomplishments or environmental accomplishments, things that that so many other governors were not even trying to do at the time, that made a big difference in that state. And at the same time, you had some very real challenges in public around issues of race and racism. Was it fair to adjudicate, both in the moment and as we look back on your time as governor, those sort of governing accomplishments alongside those concerns about race and racial inequality?
It's all part of the record, and it all has to be, it's out there, it is what it is. You know, one of the things I would say on the racial issue was the way we got dinged really was for profiling. And frankly, that had been going on with the state police for long before I came into office. And we were the ones who stepped up and said, yes, in fact, it's happening, and welcomed the federal government in to help oversee and did a very thorough look at it. And, you know, besides appointing more people of color to positions of power than any previous governor, you know, it is that's the record. It is what it is, and people interpret it in different ways. I will stand up with it and behind it because I think we did a good job. Did I do a stupid thing in Camden when I went with the state police? Yes. But that's the only time. Well, there was one other time when I repeated something that had been told to me by an African-American describing behavior of his nephews. Apparently, they were his nephews, he said. And I repeated that, and I probably shouldn't have. But beyond that, it's all part of the record, and you have to take responsibility for it. You take the good with the bad. You can't duck it. You shouldn't duck it. You shouldn't try to hide it. You just have everything out there and say, you have to be the judge of the overall record.
As I listen to you talk and think about sort of those years, the good, the bad, the difficult, the triumphant, I'm just
the ugly.
Sort of,
don't forget the ugly. It has to be the good, ugly.
All of that. I'm wondering, just as you look at the broad landscape nationally of our politics, if you are surprised at how divided we are as a nation, whether it is in our federal government or in our states. You know, New Jersey was a place that could elect a Democrat or a Republican as governor, usually pretty close to one another. The same used to be true, for example, in North Carolina. It's still a little bit true in North Carolina where I live. But overwhelmingly, that is becoming not true. States are sort of all blue or all red. Is that surprising to you?
It's disappointing is what it is. You could see it starting to happen. Even long before I became governor, we started these divides back in 64 with Goldwater. I can remember that one. I was old enough to be fairly active working for Rockefeller and then Scranton. But, you know, we started to see it, and it is what it is enormously troubling to me for the future of democracy, because we're getting to that place where people can't and won't talk to one another. They don't listen. They don't try to acknowledge that someone who might hold a different opinion may have very valid reasons for holding that opinion. And you need to talk it through and say, okay, but this is why I feel the way I do, rather than say, okay, you don't agree with me, you're my enemy. And we see so much of this happening now that it's getting down to the point where if you lose an election, it's because of fraud. There can be no other reason. And you start to undermine the public's confidence in our political system and in our rule of law and in our elections. And that's a very dangerous place for us to be as a democracy.
Christine Todd Whitman, New Jersey's first and for now only woman to serve as governor. And thank you for renewing some of my faith today in the capacity to have bipartisan conversations, to reflect on our history collectively, and to really care about our democracy. Thank you for joining us.
Well, my pleasure, and good to talk to you.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Quick question. In how many U.S. states do you think it is legal for police to lie to minors in order to get these young people to confess to crimes? It's okay if you don't know for sure. Just guess. Maybe you're thinking 4 or 5 states allow this practice. Maybe you think about half the states allow police to deceive children while interrogating them. But oh no, 48 states allow this practice. And until last month, it was legal in all 50 states. But that's when Illinois became the very first state to outlaw this practice, when Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed Senate Bill 2122 into law. For more on this, I turn to
Laura Nyreiter,
the co-director of Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions and host of the podcast Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions.
It will surprise no one who's listening who's a parent that children are more vulnerable inside the interrogation room. Children and adolescents are between 2 and 3 times as likely to falsely confess as adults.
Now, this actually happened to one of Laura's former clients. And just a heads up, y'all, this story includes sensitive topics that some might find disturbing.
My name is Terrell Swift.
One of the most compelling pieces of advocacy that led to Illinois adopting this reform was, you know, of course, the legislature held hearings about this bill before voting on it. And at the hearing testified a man named Terrell Swift, a former client of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, who was one of the so-called Englewood Four in Chicago.
Once I get to the police department, you know, I was sat down, you know, in a chair in like an office setting. And, you know, I was handcuffed to the chair, and that's when the psychological torture began, saying that I raped and murdered someone. Immediately, I was crying and I was screaming out for my mother, can I call my mother so that I can get an attorney? And nothing came of that.
Terrell was 17 years old when, after an interrogation that was filled with deception, he confessed to a brutal rape and murder that he did not commit. As did 3 other teenagers. They confessed during separate interrogations to the same crime.
I was coerced into signing a false confession after I was led details of the case by the officers. And that confession, you know, which I thought, you know, was going to lead me to go home, which is what I was promised, it ultimately didn't lead to that. It ultimately led to me losing 15 years and 3 months of my life in prison.
All 4 of them were put away for terms of decades in prison until about 15 years later, the DNA was tested in this case. Not only did it exonerate Terrell and his 3 co-defendants, but it identified the real perpetrator, right? A man who had gone on to terrorize the South Side of Chicago and commit a series of additional rapes and murders while these innocent teenagers did his time.
My time in prison, you know, I tried to make the best out of an unfortunate situation. So for like 10 years, I went to college. I got associate degrees, various trade school, trade certificates in building maintenance, horticulture, culinary arts, just different things, just trying to occupy my time. I was doing that and I was writing lawyers and working out, just trying to stay, you know, stay positive. And, you know, not get in any trouble while I was there, because I always knew that I was going to continue to fight for my name, because, I mean, you're nothing in this world without your name. And my name was Scar. And I knew that I was going to get out whenever I was able to get out. I was going to continue to fight. And that's what I was able to do.
In prison, Terrell wrote to lawyers about his case all the time. But it wasn't until nearly 15 years into his sentence that lawyers from Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions came to visit him. And they told him they thought he was innocent.
You know, I just started crying even more. You know, it's like I've been waiting for years, right, for someone to look at my case. And before we did anything in court, you know, or anything, I just knew that I would be okay, because I had a lawyer. I had lawyers that really saw the injustice that we went through. And I knew that we would be okay.
Terrell told us how it felt to help get the Illinois bill passed.
It's some good that came out of a bad situation. And that's how I look at it. You know, I look at, you know, even my prison time. I can't be mad at it, because I always have a bitterness about what I lost, but I can't like continue to live in that hatred, because if I did, you know, I don't think I would be able to, you know, be proactive and be helpful and being able to help pass this bill. So with that, you know, with everything that I've been through, my other co-defendants, you know, many other young Black males that have been through the same thing that we've been through, it felt good to see that we're making progress. It's 2021 and we're just signing a bill saying that police can't lie to the youth, when it's already proven that a 17-year-old or a youth's brain is not fully developed and they're easily manipulated. And we're thankful that they're finally passing the bill. But again, it is 2021. We should have been doing this.
Since being exonerated in 2012, Terrell has been working, spending time with his kids, and trying to enjoy his life. And he's speaking out to bring awareness to those who are still incarcerated, although they were wrongfully convicted. Helping pass this bill was a first step.
I mean, moving forward, I mean, it is a big step, and definitely we think that it could have changed our lives. But, you know, moving forward, we hope that it will stop someone else being another Terrell Swift, Michael Saunders, Harold Richardson, and Vincent Thames.
Thank you, Terrell Swift, for sharing your story with us. And now, let's turn back to my conversation with Laura Nyreiter. She and her team at the Center on Wrongful Convictions have been working a long time to expose the risk of false confessions when police lie in interrogations. She consulted on the Senate bill in Illinois, together with the National Innocence Project and the Illinois Innocence Project, making Illinois the first state in the U.S. to pass a law that prohibits police from lying in interrogations to people younger than 18. I asked what it meant for her to finally see this bill signed into law.
This is a groundbreaking, historic bill. It passed with bipartisan support, and it means so much to those of us who have spent our careers working in the area of wrongful convictions. You know, for 2.5 decades, organizations like the Center on Wrongful Convictions and the Innocence Project, attorneys there have been working to exonerate people across the country who confessed to serious crimes that DNA testing later proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that they did not commit. And of course, the question then arises, as hundreds and hundreds of these false confessions have emerged, why would anyone confess to a crime that he or she didn't commit? Turns out the answer has everything to do with the use of these deceptive, manipulative interrogation techniques that our police have been trained to use for decades. Turns out those techniques are a significant risk factor for false confessions. And this bill is the first in U.S. history to take direct aim at those techniques.
You know, when you phrase it as saying this is a bill that makes it, that prohibits police officers from lying to children. Like, I think, I mean, certainly the first time that I heard about the bill, I was like, wait a minute, was it not already illegal to lie to children during an interrogation? So pause and just step back and walk our listeners a little bit through sort of what kinds of scenarios we're talking about, what kinds of lies are being told.
Sure. And by the way, that is the universal response to this bill, right? Everybody has the reaction that you had. I can't believe this is allowed in the first place, right? So, you know, the kinds of lies that this bill takes aim at, they're really two types, right? The first category of lies are lies about the evidence. It is commonplace. And again, police are trained that during interrogation, they should confront the suspect with a rock solid case against them in order to reduce them down to a sense of hopelessness, of being cornered. And part of the techniques police are trained to use during that first stage of interrogation is lies about the evidence. So it's quite common for police to say things like, "We found your DNA at the scene," or "We found your fingerprints on the gun," when those things aren't true. So those kinds of lies about the evidence are one type of lie that this bill targets. The other type of lie is lies about the consequences of confessing, right? Once you make the suspect feel trapped, cornered, hopeless, we've got mountains of evidence against you, no one will believe that you're innocent. Police officers are trained to suggest falsely to a suspect that confessing will help them, right? So you see police officers saying things like, "If you don't confess, you know, they'll throw the book at you, you'll get the death penalty, you've got life in prison. But if you do confess, if you show remorse, if you cooperate, it'll be a slap on the wrist, right? Just a couple of years, maybe you can even go home tonight." When of course, you know, in a serious case, a murder case, a sexual assault case, of course, if you confess, you're not going home tonight, right? So it's these two categories of lies about the evidence and lies about the consequences of confessing. And by the way, those two interrogation techniques have been around and in practice. They were developed in the 1940s and 1950s, actually here at Northwestern University, where I now teach. At the time, these psychological techniques were thought of as really progressive, really enlightened, because they replaced what had previously been in use, which was the third degree physical abuse, right? Beating somebody until they confess. So at the time, these psychological deceptive techniques were thought of as enlightened, and were even blessed by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 1969 decision called Frazier versus Cupp. But of course, since then, with the advent of DNA technology, we've been proving these confessions false at a rate that's much higher than anyone imagined. It turns out that these psychological deceptive techniques are just as coercive, just as capable of producing false confessions as confessions obtained with physical abuse.
It's so helpful to understand that particular historic context, that psychological techniques, that tactics of deception do seem like a progressive betterment over physical torture. Like, I get how we sort of start moving down that line. But now here we are, you know, quite a bit later, right? Nearly 100 years later, if you're talking about the 1930s, right? So nearly 100 years later, acknowledging that it's not only, you know, problematic for the defendant, right? But obviously that we're also, if you're getting a false confession, it means someone who did commit a crime in this case, right, isn't paying for that crime, isn't being caught and maybe stopped from other crimes. But talk to me about the minors aspect. So particularly when you're talking about these psychological techniques, how do they work differently with, you know, young people?
So Illinois is home to 100 proven false confessions, the most of any state in the country. And out of those 100, 31 false confessions came from people under the age of 18, right? Teenagers and children are just more malleable, more susceptible to influence, more vulnerable to pressure than adults. And that's why you see this rash of false confessions affecting some of the youngest members of our community. So I think what you see, what we saw in Illinois with this bill was not only a recognition that kids are more vulnerable, but that, you know, wrongful convictions are a public safety issue. And that's why I think at the end of the day, we were able to garner such compelling and strong law enforcement support for this bill. We had the Illinois Chiefs of Police. We had the Illinois State's Attorneys Association, the state prosecutor organization. We had deep support from law enforcement training organizations. No one wants an innocent person behind bars while the guilty person is free to continue, you know, committing harms in a community.
You've talked a little bit about the breadth of support, bipartisan support, support by the state's chiefs of police. Talk to me a little bit about what's in the bill. If this is a tactic taught to law enforcement and that has been taught to law enforcement for decades and has been used very recently, how in the world does the bill actually stop this in practice? What are the penalties for police who use it? And who's going to oversee changing how interrogations are done?
Sure. It's a great question. So under this bill, if a police officer uses deceptive tactics during an interrogation of somebody under the age of 18, any confession that results will be presumed to be inadmissible in court. Right. So it cannot be used as evidence because the risk that this confession might be false is simply too high. But here's the good news, right? Here's one reason I'm really excited about the way we've thought about implementing this bill. We worked hand in hand with law enforcement training organizations to vet that language and to think about what concrete changes will happen inside the interrogation room as a result of this bill. It turns out that there are plenty of alternative interrogation techniques out there that are less coercive, that run a much lower risk of false confessions, but that are still capable of obtaining statements from guilty people and that still allow police to be able to close cases and to be able to solve crimes. You know, these kinds of deceptive interrogation techniques, just as one example, were prohibited in 1984 in the United Kingdom after a slew of false confession cases came to light there in the 1970s. So, of course, police officers, Scotland Yard in the UK, they've been solving crimes with no problem absent these techniques. And so
they also managed to police communities without, you know, guns. But like a lot of things are going on different in the UK.
Totally. But I'm glad you raised that, too, because, you know, that's another aspect of this use of deception during interrogation. Right. That I think about a lot. When you're talking about the interaction between police and the communities that they're supposed to serve, right, lies cannot be part of a foundation that breeds trust, right? I mean, if you have these deceptive interactions, of course, the community, that contributes to this sense of mistrust between communities and police. And you know, there's just no reason for this technique to be in use any longer. It's outdated. It raises the risk of false confessions. It breeds mistrust between communities and police. And it's not needed to solve crimes.
So tell me then, if there is a universal sort of reaction like I had, what do you mean? I can't even believe this is legal. And then, as I just heard you say, there are all of these alternatives, and this is not even effective as a sort of crime fighting technique. Talk to me about the breadth and the depth. So one, is this going to move beyond Illinois? Do we see bills like this being introduced in other states in the nation? And also on depth, will it go beyond minors so that officers also cannot lie to adult suspects?
Well, I am pleased to report that on the very same day that Illinois became the first state in U.S. history to adopt this reform, Oregon adopted a similar bill, a nearly identical bill. So right now it's two states in the country, Illinois and Oregon, that ban police from lying to children during interrogations. And there are other bills that have been introduced and that are going to be introduced in states across the country. New York has a bill pending, for example, right now, that not only would ban police from lying to kids, but as you suggest, also would ban police from lying to adults. Because of course, deception and these sorts of deeply manipulative interrogation techniques, they work on adults as well as kids, right? We know, of course, of hundreds and hundreds of false confession cases in which the person who confessed was an adult. So in Illinois and in Oregon, we took an incrementalist approach insofar as we began with kids. They are the most vulnerable during interrogation. We were able to build that consensus with law enforcement around kids. But as we see this reform taking off around the country, I believe we're looking at the beginning of a wave of similar reforms around the country. I think it is going to spread not only to kids, but also to protections that adults need too. Once we realize that these tactics, they're just not needed and they're just too risky for us to be using them.
I'm going to see if I can start a a movement that any state that introduces a bill against critical race theory also has to introduce a bill that makes it illegal for officers to lie to children during interrogation. Laura Nyreiter is co-director of Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions and host of the podcast Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's the show. I really appreciate y'all tuning in. I'm enjoying this little thing called radio so much. And speaking of radio, we want y'all to be a part of it with us. Here at The Takeaway, we're asking you to share with us what your life sounds like. Do you live in a noisy city? Are you a stay-at-home parent? Do you have pets? We want to hear the sounds of your life. So start making it a practice to take out your mobile phone or just an old-fashioned tape recorder. Catch a minute or two of what your life sounds like. Then send those voice memos to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Very soon, we'll start bringing your sound stories to life right here on The Takeaway. And of course, call us with your show ideas and suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.